So was I still on slide four when I had to shut up? It's all the farther we've gotten. All right. Well, I told you most things I wanted to tell you about this, except I didn't mention the frenula. There are multiple frenula, which is the plural of frenulum, which are just little flaps, membrane-like flaps that keep things in place. So there's a superior labial frenulum holding your lips to the gums. What are the gums called? What is inflammation of the gums? Gingivitis. Therefore, what are the gums called? Gingiva. The gingiva. So labial means of the lips, remember? So superior labial frenulum is that flap that holds your upper lip to the upper gingiva, and there's one on the lower lip as well, inferior labial frenulum. But there's also a lingual frenulum, and lingual means of what? Of the tongue, right? What's another name for the tongue, by the way? Glossa. G-L-O-S-S-A. So when you see glosso as a combining form in words, that means the tongue is somehow involved. Okay, well, I think that's the only things I hadn't mentioned. Oh, I guess I didn't mention that the palate includes rugi. That's a word we'll see later in the chapter as well. Ruga is a kind of a coarse fold in a surface. And so, as we'll see a little bit later, the stomach also has rugi in its interior surface. Okay, now to five. Well, speaking of the glossa, we're looking at the tongue here. And the overall tongue is bigger than you're probably imagining. Includes more than what you probably think of colloquially as the tongue. Most people call just the body of the tongue the tongue. That's the part that you can actually move around and stick out and whatnot. But the overall tongue includes the body and the root. And the root is the attachment place. The body of the tongue is, of course, attached to the root, but that's the only attachment other than the frenulum to the floor of the oral cavity. The root, though, is pharyngeal. It occupies the part of the pharynx, whereas the body of the tongue is in the oral cavity. And I'm not going to mention the papillae again. I just did mention them. I'm not going to go through the different kinds of papillae and taste buds again, because that was 201 information. And that's, even though they get involved when you eat, which is a function of the digestive system, their operation is really sensory, right? And that's why it was covered in 201. It's not really about digestion. The tongue, by the way, is a muscular organ. And so there are muscles of the tongue, but those occur in two categories. There are intrinsic muscles of the tongue and extrinsic muscles of the tongue. Now, intrinsic means occurring within. So the intrinsic muscles of the tongue are actually part of the tongue. They give it its mass. And the extrinsic muscles of the tongue attach to the tongue, but they're outside of the tongue. Now they both kinds, of course, affect the movement of the tongue, as muscles would be expected to. The extrinsic muscles of the tongue are responsible for very gross movements, exaggerated movements of the tongue, which are important during mastication. Now, the tongue is more than just a digestive organ, right? It's also, like I said, a sensory organ, so it's important in nervous system function. But it's also important for speech. If you stop and think about what your tongue is doing. Like I said before, it's amazing that it doesn't get bitten. Well, it's also just amazing the number of shapes that it assumes in a short amount of time, just when you're pronouncing a sentence, let alone chewing. It undergoes a lot of shape change. It's also a little bit weird as a muscle. Well, it's not just one muscle, but when you think of muscles, they're usually connected at both ends, right? This tongue is attached at one end. How is it, by the way, that since you know, or hopefully remember, that muscles, when they operate actively, can only get shorter, how is it that your tongue, you can stick your tongue out, make it longer, actively? Right. It's not just one muscle. There are multiple intrinsic muscles of the tongue. Some of them are longitudinally arranged. So if you stimulate those, they'll contract. That will make your tongue shorter. Right? But there are also ones that are transverse in their grain. They go across the tongue, left to right. And when those get shorter, you know, you don't eliminate the mass of the tongue, it stays the same. So when you make the tongue narrower by shortening those muscles, the only thing that can happen is for it to get longer to take up the same amount of volume. By the way, when you look at the individual names of the muscles, notice that a lot of them have the glosso combining form in it. Hyoglossal, named for the fact that it's connected to the hyoid bone and the glossus. A lot of these are connected to the hyoid bone. Remember the hyoid bone? What's its claim to fame? It doesn't articulate with any other bone, right? But it's a hard connection point, a stiff connection point for a bunch of muscles, including ones that connect on the other end to the tongue. All right. Now we can go to 6 and talk about dentition, or the teeth. We're not the only organisms, of course, that have teeth. There's quite a variety of tooth types, depending on the species. But also, part of that variety is that the teeth themselves, from species to species, can be totally different. For instance, if you look at a horse's teeth, it doesn't have the same shaped teeth as it looks like all molars, basically, right? Shark's teeth are like all incisors. Depends on what the thing is eating and how it's eating it as to what shape the teeth are, by natural selection, of course. But there's also a variety of tooth types from animal to animal with respect to how long those teeth hang around. And so we are examples of animals that happen to have normally 2 sets of teeth. We have a deciduous set of teeth, which most people call the baby teeth. First, those are the first ones to erupt. Now, they're formed before they erupt. By erupt, I mean show up. When you say, I got my first tooth, or whatever, if your parent says you got your first tooth, that tooth existed before you saw it. Eruption, I mean, it develops first and then it erupts from the gingiva. Anyway, they're called deciduous teeth for what reason? What does that refer to? Well, where else have you heard that word applied to? Trees, right. What are deciduous trees? Which ones? They do lose their leaves. Right. An evergreen, a tree that has leaves all year round is not deciduous. A deciduous tree is one that loses its leaves in the fall. Right. They fall off in autumn. So that's what deciduous refers to. And similarly, deciduous teeth, or the baby teeth, are so called because they only last a certain number of years and then they fall out. They fall out to make room for the secondary teeth, which are also called the permanent teeth, even though that word doesn't apply to everyone. You can still lose permanent teeth, but you're not getting a third set, is the point. Now, there are some organisms that do. I mean, back to a shark as an example. Their teeth are deciduous throughout their lifetime, and they're always growing new ones. Why would they do that? I mean, they lose them easily too, but why keep producing new teeth? Yeah, there is a lot of wear, and that's the point. And making new ones, in the case of a shark, ensures that they're always sharp. They get dull as they use them, right? So they don't just let them get dull. They basically let them drop out, and they get replaced by a brand new sharp one throughout their lifetime. So they don't have a set number of sets of teeth. We do, though. Two sets. The deciduous teeth and the permanent teeth. And the numbers of those two sets of teeth differ, as you see here. So there's how many baby teeth in a normal human? 20, right? What we're looking at here on the deciduous teeth is just one arch. You have an upper arch and a lower arch, one for the upper part of the jaw, one for the lower part of the jaw. By the way, how many bones are involved when it comes to teeth? Three. You have one mandible, that's the lower jaw, right? It starts out as two bones, but by the time you're developed, it's there's a symphysis, so it's all one, or synostosis, so it's one bone. But there are two maxillae, right? And they remain separate bones throughout your life. So the upper jaw is actually two bones, the lower jaw is one bone. But this arc, this arched shape arrangement of teeth, there's one above and one below, and so you can multiply what you see here by two, right? Well, there are a few different categories of tooth shapes. Incisors are called that for what reason? What does that actually mean? They make incisions. They make clean cuts. So they are narrow, blade-like, sharp teeth. And you find those on the front, which is where they're useful to bite something off in one snip. So the central incisors are so named, of course, because they're right in the front, the very center of the arch. The lateral incisors can be called... the lateral incisors are to the side of the central incisors, which is what lateral means. The next one, moving from the middle toward the back of the arch, are the canines. Now, they're named that for the fact that they are what are very prominent in a dog and other kinds of mammals, right? They have very long canines, not so long in most humans, unless they're vampires. But what's another name for canines? No, I mean for canine teeth. Yes, dogs is another name for canines. Another name for canines is bicuspid teeth. They have two cusps. The teeth behind them are molars of some sort, which usually have more cusps. And the molars vary drastically in their shape from species to species. But why are molars called molars? What does that word refer to? Refers to grinding. They act as mills. That's what the two words share as a root. They are the mills of the jaw. A mill is something you use to grind things into fine pieces, right? So they're kind of flat teeth, but not perfectly flat. They have these cusps on them that fit into each other, the top version and the lower one, fit into each other, and therefore with just slight lateral excursions of the jaw and protractions and retractions of the jaw, you can move these molars with respect to each other and the food that's between them and grind it into pretty small pieces. So two sets of molars, a first molar and a second molar in the deciduous teeth, you lose those. And by the way, when you lose them varies from tooth to tooth on average. These are, of course, averages. But the age at eruption is shown there. They come in at different times. You lose them at different times as well. The age of eruption of the permanent teeth is shown, by the way, down here, which usually corresponds to the age at which you lose them, the deciduous teeth, the corresponding deciduous teeth. But there are more permanent teeth than there are deciduous teeth. You have an extra set of molars, basically. So you still have central incisors, lateral incisors, canines in the same positions, but they are bigger teeth, of course, because you have a bigger head by then. Notice that the molars, though, the overall molars, are broken into premolars. You have a first and second premolar. And then first and second molars, at least, the last ones to erupt, and in fact, they don't always even erupt. I never even got mine, or the third molars, are wisdom teeth. Now, they are in my jaw. You can x-ray them and see them, but they just never erupted, and hopefully never will at this point. Okay, that's teeth. Now, let's look at a single tooth in slide 7 and its relationship with the jaw bone, whichever of those three bones are involved. So this happens to be a molar that we're looking at, but the same terminology applies to the other teeth as well. A tooth has to be hard, of course, in order to do a good job of standing up to all the abrasive force that chewing or mastication presents. If it weren't hard, and you only had that one set, you would quickly wear them out, and they wear out anyway. Of course, over evolutionary time, they probably didn't wear out as much because people only lived to be about 20. But now, if you take care of them, they can last decades, and that's because the enamel that covers the visible part of the tooth, which is the crown, is the hardest stuff that animals make. It's much harder than bone, and therefore stands up to that abuse pretty well. The overall tooth, as you see, has two major parts, the crown and the root. The crown simply means the part that you can see above the gum line, and the root is below the gum line, so you're not supposed to see that unless you are performing surgery or something. Well, the neck that's labeled here is simply the narrow line where the crown meets the root, right at the gum line. Now, as I said, the gum itself is called the gingiva. Where that gum line is, where gum meets tooth, there is the gingival sulcus. What did we say sulcus means? Groove, right, just like on the surface of the cerebrum. The gyri and the sulci. So the gingival sulcus is something that you need to be mindful of as part of oral hygiene if you want your teeth to last, because that's a place that's especially well suited for bacteria to live. And it's not so much the bacteria that are the problem. It's the fact that when they metabolize the sugars that they're living on, that are in your mouth, that they're using as their food, they produce an acidic environment. And that acidity erodes the enamel slowly. Just like the acidity of Coke or some other, I don't care, I'll say Coke. Sodas in general can be acidic, and that can erode your teeth as well. Well, anyway, it's bad news to erode your enamel, because enamel is not cellular. Enamel is extracellular material that gets built one time, and then that's your enamel. So you're losing it from the point you have those permanent teeth onward for the rest of your life. It's going to be degraded bit by bit, and if it gets thin enough, then you start having problems in the interior of the tooth, which is bad news for the health of that tooth. Well, the overall shape of the tooth, because it has these roots, is that it is like a peg in a socket. What kind of joint is it? It's a gomphosis, correct. In fact, that's the only place in your body where there are gomphoses. Tooth in a socket is a gomphosis joint. Now, as you would expect there to be between, because teeth are basically modified bones, as you would expect for there to be between bones, there are ligaments between the root of the tooth and the bony material that it's embedded in, the jawbone, in other words. That ligament, or that set of ligaments, are the periodontal ligaments.
Is that labeled anywhere?
Oh yeah, right here. So all these little pink bands make up the periodontal ligament, which is fibrous connective tissue, made up of fibrous connective tissue, just like other ligaments are, really. Not very long bands. In other words, there's not much space between the hard root of the tooth and the hard interior surface of the bone, but there is a gap, and that gap is filled by the periodontal ligament. This, of course, holds the tooth in place, but that's just part of its function. If the root of the tooth were firmly embedded in the jawbone, in other words, if the tooth were not able to move with respect to the jaw, then you would much more easily crack your teeth by chewing on something hard. You try to crack an unpopped kernel of corn, for instance, that would transfer a lot more force to the surface of the enamel than it would if you do it with a periodontal ligament in place. In other words, teeth have a little bit of give to them, and you can notice this when you're chewing. Your teeth move around. You can feel that they're moving around. Now, it's not a gross movement unless you're about to lose that tooth, but it moves a little bit, and that makes all the difference with respect to transferring that force to the enamel. If you chewed on something that's perfectly in place, you would crack the tooth pretty easily. At the bottom of the roots, there's a passageway called an apical foramen. Apical means of the apex. That's the tip, the end of the root. And that's a communication canal through which vessels and nerves run. So there are blood vessels, lymphatic vessels, and nerves that go through there and then up into the tooth itself. The bulk of the tooth, if we look at the interior of it, the bulk of the tooth is made up of dentin. It's all this orange stuff. Now, dentin is cellular, and so it does repair itself, but the enamel that gets secreted, like I said, does not. The deepest part, the reddish one right here, is the pulp, and that's also the loosest tissue-wise of all of it. It's fairly loose connective tissue that fills what we call the pulp cavity, as you see. I remember what I wanted to ask. So, the socket of this peg and socket relationship, this gomphosis, what is the socket itself called? Each tooth socket is an example of what? What is a name that means little sac? Because that's what a socket is, kind of. It's like a little sac in shape. What did you say? Alveoli, right. Each tooth socket is an alveolus. And so the jaw has many alveoli that are filled by the many teeth to form gomphoses. All right, let's go to 8. In 8, we're looking at several things, but the main point of the slide here is that there are salivary glands. Now, there are, technically speaking, many salivary glands, but a lot of them are just microscopic. So you don't see them as conspicuous glands if you dissect something. And so they are spread out in the tongue and surrounding soft tissue. And they create saliva as well. Salivary glands in general create and secrete saliva. But there are pairs of, three major pairs of macroscopic salivary glands that you can easily see with dissection. And those are the parotid glands. Now, there's one, there's a left and a right version of all three of these, of course. That's why I meant by paired. The parotid glands are named that for what reason? What does that mean? Well, what does para mean? Next, an otid or otic. Now, optic is eye or light. Otic means of the ear. So what we call an ear, nose, and throat specialist is really an otolaryngologist or an otonasolaryngologist, if it's all three. An otologist is just an ear specialist. All right, so parotid or paraotic means next to the ears. That's exactly where the parotid glands are found. And those are the ones you can easily push on, and your mouth will start watering because the pressure you exert forces that saliva through their ducts into the oral cavity. You also have a pair of submandibular glands, and you can push on those as well. Those are on the interior of the arch that your mandible makes, but that's why they're called submandibular. They're right under the mandible. And there are also sublingual under the tongue glands that are not so easy to push with your fingers. All right, well, they all do the same job. They all produce saliva. And why is it that saliva is important? Yeah, for one thing, it begins the process of chemical digestion. Mechanical digestion starts in the mouth, continues in the stomach, and to a lesser extent in the small intestine by gross movements, right? But as soon as you start mastication, which leads to salivation, you also start chemical digestion. And not just everything that you're eating gets chemically digested in the mouth, only a little bit, right? What are the classes of nutrients that get, or molecules that get chemically digested in the mouth because of salivary contents? Starch. What is starch an example of? It is a storage polysaccharide, exactly. So polysaccharides are long chains of monosaccharides, right? Well, those start getting dismantled right in the mouth before you even swallow, because saliva contains what's called salivary amylase. And in fact, that name tells you what it does, because amyl means starch. One form of starch is called amylose. Amylase is able to dismantle it into the individual, or break it down into smaller pieces of monosaccharides stuck together. So that is the major chemical digestion that occurs because of saliva. What else, though, does saliva contain? What other nutrient class starts to get digested chemically? Lipids, right. And what do we call an enzyme that digests a lipid? A lipase. The lipase that becomes part of saliva gets comes from which structure? It comes from the tongue. Therefore, we call that specific kind of lipase lingual lipase. Okay, so salivary amylase and lingual lipase begin chemical digestion. But lingual lipase doesn't get much of its job done in the mouth. And I think I told you last time, why is that? It actually starts working a lot better once it's in the stomach because of the pH change, right? Every enzyme, not just digestive enzymes, every enzyme has an optimal pH at which it works. It also has an optimal temperature at which it works. You get a temperature or a pH too high or too low, it changes the shape of that enzyme. Well, the shape is everything for the function, right? You change the shape, you change the function. Well, lingual lipase doesn't work very well at the slightly basic pH, the normal pH of the mouth. But it works very well at the much lower pH, the acidic environment of the stomach. And after all, that's the next stop, right? You don't keep something in your mouth very long unless you pass out with a mouthful of food. By the way, if you pass out with a mouthful of food, and I'm not recommending that you do, if it's beef jerky, you're still going to have beef jerky in your mouth when you wake up in the morning, because that's mostly protein, right? And protein does not get degraded by, it doesn't get chemically digested. So however much you've chewed up to that point, you'll get mechanical digestion, but it'll still be intact proteins in your mouth. On the other hand, if you pass out with a saltine in your mouth, which has a lot of starch in it, you already know that it does. You don't actually have to pass out. It'll dissolve pretty quickly because it's actually being chemically digested. All right, well, those are the three sets of macroscopic major salivary glands. But like I said, there's just thousands of tiny collections of cells also producing saliva throughout the tongue and cheeks. In 9, we're looking at a close-up of just a part of one of these major salivary glands. And these salivary glands are classified as what kind of gland? When you think of glands overall, there's two major categories, right? What are the major categories? Endocrine and exocrine, right? What is the difference? One does have a duct. You want to be specific and say which one? Right. Exocrine glands have ducts. Endocrine glands don't. Endocrine glands release their secretions immediately into the interstitium, but they make their way into the bloodstream, right? We're talking about hormones. Exocrine glands, on the other hand, release their secretion through the lumen of a duct onto some surface. Now, that can be an internal surface, an external surface, like your sweat glands or exocrine glands. But that's what qualifies them as exocrine. They have a duct, including salivary glands. You can see the salivary duct there, lined by cells. The arrangement of these glands, though, is acinar, acinar, which means like an acinus. What does that mean, though? No? Aster is star. It means like a bunch of grapes, which you can kind of see in this cartoon here. So these little blind-ended pouches that are connected to the duct are acini. This one's an acinus, this one's an acinus, and so on. All right. The saliva is a mixture of things, but there are two major components to it. There's a watery component, what word do we use to say that something is watery? Serous, right. Serous means watery. Serum is a watery substance. Thin, not very viscous. That's why we call serous membranes serous membranes. The serous fluid is watery. That's why we call blood serum serum, because once you remove the fibrinogen from the plasma, it's pretty thin material. So anyway, there's a serous component to a watery component to the saliva, but there's also a mucus component. There's mucus in saliva, and then there's a bunch of other stuff in the watery or serous component. By the way, the serous component contains not only the digestive enzymes that we talked about, but it also contains lysozyme, which is an enzyme that protects you from bacteria. It kills bacteria and other things as well, salts and whatnot. But the mucus component is made by mucus cells, whereas the serous component is made by serous cells. Now, they're all cells that are part of the gland, but they have a division of labor. The mucus cells produce their own product. The serous cells produce the other product. They get mixed when the two kinds of cells secrete them together. Now, the salivary duct itself is actually contributing to this. The salivary duct has cells that are also contribute to the serous component. The mucus component, though, gets produced by mucus cells, which are the yellowish ones in this cartoon. Well, any given gland or any given subunit of the overall gland, which is what we're looking at here, a major subunit, can have either serous acini only, or mucus acini only, or mixed acini. A mixed acinus is simply one that has both mucus cells and serous cells. All right. I don't think I need to beat that horse anymore. Let's go on to 10. Well, here we're looking at swallowing. What do you know that as? Everyone? Yes, it's deglutition. That is the swallowing. And swallowing, of course, is what delivers food, and it's still proper to call it food at this point, to the stomach, where it's no longer called food by the time it gets there. Once it's in the stomach, what do we call the stuff? Chyme, C-H-Y-M-E. Right. So swallowing is really not about digestion. It's part of the digestive system's functions, but it's really just to get the stuff from one place in the alimentary canal to the next quickly. In other words, the esophagus, which of course is the tube that joins the pharynx with the stomach, does not store stuff. And there's very, very little absorption that can occur through the epithelium lining the esophagus. Some water could, maybe a couple ions, but no real nutrients get absorbed at the esophagus, and nothing stays there long enough for it to happen anyway. What we see in slide 10 is that deglutition consists of three phases. There's an oral phase, a pharyngeal phase, and an esophageal phase. Well, the oral phase, of course, is named for the fact that stuff's happening in the oral cavity, in the mouth. And so what precedes this, of course, is mastication, assuming this is a solid rather than just drinking. If this is food that you're chewing first, chewing not only accomplishes mechanical digestion, but it also mixes the food with saliva. In other words, you don't just coat the exterior of a bite of food with saliva. You chew it up so that the saliva can get mixed all the way through the thickness of that piece of food. And you do that not only to expose the enzymes that saliva contains to as many particles of that food as possible, but also because of the mucus content of saliva, you stick it together. You stick together the little pieces of food into one major piece. And that one major piece of food that you're about to swallow is called a bolus. So it's not just food by that point. It's food and saliva mixed. But assuming you've properly chewed, because of that mastication, it's not a hard sphere of food that doesn't change shape very much like it would if you just bit off a chunk and tried to swallow it immediately without chewing. because you've masticated it into tiny pieces that are stuck together, it's a glob of food that can easily change shape as it gets pushed through the pharynx first and then the esophagus. It's malleable. Okay, well, when you have sufficiently chewed, and you do this automatically all the time, of course, when you've chewed so that you think it's enough chewing to swallow, you, with complicated motions of the tongue versus the roof of the mouth and everything else, you basically collect all these little pieces and the saliva into the bolus of food and push it backward in the mouth toward the opening to the oropharynx. Remember that the pharynx is split into three parts, right? Nasopharynx, oropharynx, and laryngopharynx. That's the oral phase. Pushing it all the way into the laryngopharynx begins the pharyngeal phase. And by the way, there's a swallowing reflex. So you consciously determine when you're going to swallow, but once you start that, a reflex takes over. You can't say, "Oh, I decided not to swallow." Basically, it's going to continue, and the bolus of food gets pushed into the pharynx. But in so doing, the body takes steps to ensure that this food is going to be put into the correct exit from the pharynx. Remember, I said the pharynx is kind of like a hallway with different doors that you can go different rooms into. You don't want that bolus of food going into the exit from the pharynx that leads to the lungs, right? You don't want it, in other words, to go into the trachea, which is why the epiglottis is so situated. The bolus of food will slip with respect to the epiglottis and force that epiglottis to close that tracheal opening. And hopefully that food's not going to go into the trachea. If you try to take a breath, all of a sudden you can accidentally do that, and that's going to immediately cause a strong coughing reflex to get it out of there. But normally the bolus of food is not going to enter the trachea. Instead, it's sent to the only other exit on that end of the pharynx, which is to the esophagus. And remember, I was talking about the trachea originally in the respiratory system and comparing it to the esophagus. They're both tubes, but constructed much differently, right? The trachea is a tube that needs to always be open, which is why you have those C-shaped cartilages. But the esophagus is the one that I've likened to the pool emptying hose that's normally flat, unless it's being used at the moment. It's not actually, doesn't actually have a lumen. That's true of the esophagus. The only thing the esophagus is for is to get stuff from the mouth to the stomach, and that's not happening continuously. So keep it closed, making room for other things that are next to it while you're not swallowing. Well, there are one thing that keeps it from or keeps it being empty during swallowing episodes is that there is a sphincter on either end of the esophagus. So there's what's called an upper esophageal sphincter and a lower esophageal sphincter. Interestingly, the upper esophageal sphincter is skeletal muscle, but it's an example of skeletal muscle that you actually don't have conscious control over. So it's controlled by the reflex only. Anyway, that's... And also, even though it acts as a sphincter, it's a functional sphincter, it's not a ring of muscle that's prominent that you can see on dissection. It's just the top of the esophagus. The lower one can be called either the lower esophageal sphincter or the cardiac sphincter because the region of the stomach into which the esophagus directly empties is called the cardia of the stomach. It's also in the region of the heart, the cardiac. Cardiac means of the heart. Anyway, these are both normally closed when you're not swallowing. In the pharyngeal phase, that upper esophageal sphincter, by a reflex, relaxes and allows entry of the bolus into the esophagus. Once it gets past the sphincter, and it's just in the main part of the esophagus, peristalsis takes over, which is wave-like contraction of muscles. The esophagus has a muscular wall, but the grain of those muscles is circular all along the length. So, and they, you know, the entire wall does not contract at once. The upper part contracts. That pushes the bolus a little bit farther. Then the next lower ring contracts, pushes a little farther. That's what peristalsis is. And this is why, as I was saying, you could eat or drink upside down if you wanted to. It would still get to your stomach, even though it's working against gravity, because it's being muscularly pushed by peristalsis. So the esophageal phase ends when the bolus reaches the bottom of the esophagus, and in order for that bolus to enter the stomach, you have to have, as part of that esophageal phase, relaxation of the cardiac sphincter at the other end. Otherwise, you would have the food stuck in the esophagus itself. So that cardiac sphincter relaxes, allows the bolus in, and then the sphincter closes behind it until you swallow again. 11. Now we can go to the stomach, which is, of course, the next organ in line in terms of what's happening here. The stomach has all the major layers that we talked about for the alimentary canal in the slide last time. But when it comes to the muscular layer, it actually has three layers of muscle. There is a longitudinal muscular layer, a circular layer, and an oblique layer. So the longitudinal layer is named for the fact that its grain runs along the length of the organ. The stomach is somewhat longer than it is wide, and so this direction is longitudinal. Circular, because it wraps around, it's actually transverse in grain, but it wraps around the body of the muscle. And then oblique simply means at some other angle, right? So just like your abdominal muscles, there are two layers that are at right angles to each other, and then one diagonal layer. Now, why would the stomach have these three distinct layers? Because it churns, right? A major job of the stomach is to mix well the chyme. To mix it, you know, it comes in as food officially, becomes chyme when it's in the stomach, but chyme is not only different from food because it's in a different place. It's different because the stomach adds things to it. Stomach is a gland as well. It contains millions of glands, really tiny glands, that secrete various things, collectively called gastric juice. And we'll talk about the components of the gastric juice in a minute, but that gets mixed with the food to make chyme. Well, the churning of the stomach, which happens in all directions because of the grain of these three layers of muscles, effectively kneads the food and the gastric juice together, just like you would knead, you know, if you make meatloaf or something. You knead it all together to make it consistent. All right, so that aids in doing the digestive part of the stomach. The stomach is not a hugely important digestive organ. There is some digestion that takes place in it. But probably if you pooled people from the street that have never had an anatomy class, they would probably think that the stomach does the most of the digestion. That's actually not true. The stomach stores more than digests. It gets it ready for delivery into the small intestine, which actually does most of the chemical digestion. And it does that little by little by little. The more it churns, the more the chyme becomes watery, because more gastric juice is added little by little. So the chyme gets moved up and down from one end of the stomach to the next over and over. And then as it gets watery enough, a little bit is squirted at a time from the distal end of the stomach. So the stomach has two openings to it. One that is an entrance, one that's an exit. Now the cardiac sphincter is the ring of muscle that guards one of those openings, right? That's how food comes in. But there's also a sphincter at the other end called the pyloric sphincter. Pylorus is the name for the region that sphincter is located. And pylorus is a word that means gatekeeper. so-called because the pylorus is the gatekeeper between the stomach and the next thing in line in the alimentary canal, which is the small intestine. All right, so the stomach needs to have these sphincters so that once the food is in there, both of the sphincters can close off, the stomach can do its job of vigorous churning without emptying itself prematurely. The pyloric sphincter keeps it closed until the stomach says, okay, it's ready for this stuff to enter to the small intestine, which is, you know, not immediately after swallowing. It's in the stomach for quite a while. Am I out of time already? All right. We'll adjourn.